Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hi, it's Martin here. This week's episode is part two of last week's episode, which is Bill Nelson, of course. And in this episode, he talks about the latter part of his career, his particular interest in, increasing interest in ambient music and all forms of kind of future-facing music. And we get deeper into the conversation about creativity and such like. You already know who he is because I described him in depth last week. But if you've not heard part one, go and listen to it as well. It's amazing. So here he is, Bill Nelson.
They put the Red Noise album out to various radio stations at a request for comments. So they got back this sort of, a telephone book because they'd sent it to loads of radio stations. And they got the comments back. And this would, you know, whether it was released in America or not would hinge on how these DJs reacted to it. And I actually got, they gave me the comments afterwards. And they were like, what is this shit?
What is this limey shit?
And another one said, too wacko for us.
Oh, God.
So, and it was both depressing to read and hilarious at the same time. So it was never released in America.
Yeah.
We went out there on import shops would import it, but it wasn't done as an official Capitol release. And then EMI got taken over by Thorn Lighting Industries, and they changed their A&R staff around. It changed where the executives were running the company rather than the A&R people. And they dropped loads of bands like Wire. We got dropped. And that was it. That was the end of the story, you know. So I started Cocktail Records as an independent label to release a song called Daydream in Colour. Started the whole completely solo approach that I've pursued ever since. Phonogram. They had a guy called David Bates who was running the Mercury label at Phonogram, and I'd got into production. I was producing the skits, and we were down in Rockfield Studios in Wales, and David Bates was in one of the small studios at Rockfield with a band called, I think it was Dalek Eye.
Oh my God, I remember them, yeah.
Yeah. And he happened to come across into the studio where I was working producing the skits, and he said, "I haven't heard anything from you for a while. You know, what are you doing these days?" I said, "Well, I've recorded an album. It was going to be a follow-up to the Red Noise album. It's called Quit Dreaming and Get on the Beam. But EMI have decided not to release it, so they're sitting on it, and that's that, you know." And he said, "Have you got a cassette of it I can have listened to?" I said, "Yeah." And I gave him a cassette. He went away and had a listen and come back. He said, "We'll put it out."
Wow.
He said, I'll get in touch with the EMI. We'll see if we can buy it off them and we'll put it out. So that's what happened. And he released it and it went top 10.
Which just shows.
I've been sitting on it for like nearly 2 years.
Yeah. I think I've got a theory that it's a guiding principle, actually. I never, ever underestimate the listening public's desire for things that are good and different.
Yeah.
And that doesn't correlate with the way that most A&R people think, especially nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But even back then, you know, it's like they are always under pressure from the powers that be to turn a buck. Obviously, that's their job. Yeah. But anyway, sorry, carry on.
That's right. And Quit Dreaming was much more synth-based than even the Red Noise stuff. And we recorded it using the Rolling Stones truck.
Oh, right. Truck,
which we'd used, John Mackey and I used before on one of the Bebop albums. And we did it in the village where I lived. There was a little sort of village hall, which was just like a wooden shack, really. And we recorded it in that shack with the Stones truck parked outside and the wires, cables running in. And we had to vacate it on certain nights for the ladies keep fit.
That's genius.
Because
they wanted to have a beer race.
And the Quick Dreaming album had a lot more synth. In fact, there's a track on there called Life Runs Out Like Sand, which is just the Mini Moog layered lots and lots of times with the vocal on top and
great.
And a drum machine.
So you're getting into drum machines by this point?
Yeah. I mean, I've got one of those early little Roland or Boss, I don't know.
Dr. Rhythms, no?
Yeah, Dr. Rhythm.
Yeah.
That's it. I had one of those and used that.
Did you have a Lindrum?
I didn't actually have a Lindrum. I had at one point a really nice thing made by a company called HHP who did recording gear.
Yeah.
They'd come up with this. It looked like a silver metal briefcase.
Oh.
And when you opened it up, there was eight pads, largest pads, and a small control panel, and it had, you know, preloaded drum sounds in it, and you played it with sticks.
Wow, that sounds like a very James Bond thing.
Yeah. Somewhere I've got a photograph of me.
I've never heard of it. That's news to me.
And I don't know whether it actually went into full production or whether that was sort of a one-off that I managed to get.
Wow.
Some, but, it was very quickly, you know, taken over by the Lindrum thing, so...
Yeah. It's all about timing. Lindrum was great, though, I have to say. I'm aware of the time, because we're just... this is fantastic stuff. So you're moving into an ambient kind of taste for stuff now, aren't you? I've noted down... you did a bonus disc called Sounding Ritual Echo, right?
Yeah.
And then, my favourite, by the way, the stuff that I've listened to, Trial by Intimacy.
Yeah.
That is a fantastic piece of work. I mean, I honestly, I've never heard it before. I was doing some research yesterday. I just think it's completely floored me. I think it's brilliant. And you have a real talent for titles for tracks, by the way.
Yeah.
That must be the art training.
I always, you know, I always think of titles important. And, you know, sometimes you can't think of anything other than the obvious.
Do you write stuff based around a title sometimes?
Yeah. It works both ways. Sometimes I'll just do a piece that I like the sound of. And then I'll open one of many notebooks that I have where I've jotted down ideas for titles, and I think, now what does this fit? And there'll be something in there that sounds like it fits that song or that tune.
Right. So it's like balls dropping into a slot.
Yeah, it's all. I mean, the whole thing with me writing is improvisation. I mean, I used to write to tape, and now I write to software.
Yeah. I'm a big believer, I think this is very Eno-esque as well, of that whole kind of semi-random approach to composition, in terms of lyrics in particular. That kind of, you have a percentage of randomness in there that creates surprise in you and therefore will surprise the listener. That's why, anyway, I like that sort of stuff. So, Chance Encounters in the Garden of Lights.
Yeah.
That's another thing of great beauty. I dig, I like all your stuff, but I'm particularly digging this kind of scene of
Chris. Sort of minimalist.
Yeah.
Electronic, and you know, it was partly that way because of whatever facilities I had at home to record stuff.
Hey, limitations are good, though, eh?
Yeah.
I think. And so you met Gary. So there's a couple of other things here. You met Gary Newman. Did some stuff with him. Is that right?
Yeah. They wanted me to produce an album he was working on, and the record company got the idea that he kind of kept turning out the same sort of sound, and electronic pop had got kind of brighter and more just shinier.
Yeah.
They felt he needed to make that little move in that direction. So I went in there and worked with Gary on the album, and we were sort of different as chalk and cheese back then, really,
right.
Just difficult. He was all about, you know, wanting to be famous and pulling the girls and all that sort of thing, and if you get some girl down from Manchester to the studio and be off, you know, in the car or somewhere. It was difficult at times to get him properly engaged with what we were trying to do, and the engineer and myself, he had an engineer working at his own studio, which I used to check. Anyway, we eventually finished the album, and the engineer and I mixed it, and Gary was playing snooker in the games room, and I went in and said, "We've finished mixing, Gary, can we come have a listen?" And he said, "I'll listen later, mate." Okay. So I went home, and actually, with the money I'd got paid for that album, it was such hard work, I felt I'm going to blow this. And there was a second-hand Porsche in the local garage down there, in the studio. I bought this second-hand Porsche 911 and drove home with that. And the next day, or the day after that, I don't know, a couple of days after, the engineer rang me and he said, "You'll never believe this." He said, "Gary's gone in and remixed the entire album."
Uh-huh.
And the engineer said, "I've quit."
Oh, my God.
You know, it was a shame.
Jesus. Yeah.
To give Gary his credit, he has said, in recent years, he was, I remember how he put it, he wasn't very mature and it was the wrong thing and he wished, you know.
He did have a lot of success at a very young age.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can completely, I don't condone it, but I can understand how, you know, if somebody says you are King Midas and everything you touch turns to gold, then, you know, sooner or later, if you get like 3 or 4 years of that, when you start off at 19 or something, you're going to start believing it, aren't you?
Yeah.
And that's clearly where, more or less, where he was at when he worked with you, I think.
I think so, yeah. I mean, he was doing these extravagant stage shows, you know, had a little, like a hover car or something. It's kind of weird.
Right.
And, you know, he is an entertainer. I mean, that was his thing. I mean, it was a spectacle.
And yeah.
The whole illusion of, you know, but he wasn't really like that underneath, I think.
No, I interviewed him recently, Bill, and I'd never met him before because, I mean, you know, I don't know how political you are, but I'm out and proud socialist, so I didn't really get on with his Tory supporting views.
Yeah.
But I interviewed him recently, and I think he's grown up a lot. He seems like a very open, nice guy now, and acknowledges his failings in the past and stuff. So, right. So David Sylvian, who I'm a big fan of, and I've tried to get him on the podcast. Tell us about, you did some stuff with him. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think the first thing that I did was Gone to Earth, the album Gone to Earth. And I played some guitar on that, along with Robert Fripp.
God, what an absolute stellar lineup that is.
Yeah. I mean, the way that David worked was that he'd have a bare skeleton of something on tape, and he'd get people in whom he trusted, and he would just say, you know, do whatever you think you want to do.
Great.
And then we'll take another one. And then when he went away, he would then start editing everything together and use the bits that he felt were right for the song.
I quite like that way of working personally. Because it's redolent of the whole looping philosophy, isn't it? If you think about it. Yeah. Of course, on digital audio workstations now, it's almost like a default setting, but back in the day, it was quite an innovative way of working, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And so then I've got down here, you work with Roger Eno and Kate St. John. I love this term, ambient supergroup. Channel light vessel, is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. What inspired that?
I first of all was asked to play on a Roger Eno solo album, and as it happened, Kate also was asked to play on that. So John, and we went off and did a gig in Japan in Tokyo, which was. Using a Japanese violinist, cellist violinist called Mayumi, Tachibana, I think. And the guy from the record company, which was All Saints Records, which was actually the guy who owned it and ran it, was Brian Eno's brother-in-law.
Right.
And Dominic Nolan Taylor. And Dominic thought there was some mileage in putting a proper group together around what we sort of started hinting at with this solo Roger project. So we got in Miraji, who had released an album called Day of Radiance on Brian's Obscure label.
Right.
And Miraji played amplified super percussion. And then there was Kate on oboe and saxophone, and me on guitars, Roger on piano, on keys, and Mayumi on cello, on violin. And we did an album called Excellent Spirits. Now, we started recording down at Peace Gabriel's Real World Studios, and it was set to be produced by a guy called Marcus Drawers, who was Brian's engineer. And I, at this point in time, I'd separate from my wife, was getting a divorce, and I'd moved to Japan.
Right.
And was living with my current wife in Japan, in Tokyo. And after we'd recorded the album, it was left to Marcus to mix, and we went back to Japan. And I got a call from Dominic to say, I've got the finished mixes, and I'm not sure we can release this. It's not really what I hoped it would be.
Mm.
So I said, oh, yeah, well, can you send me a cassette of the mixes and I'll have a listen? And he sent me over to Japan and I heard it. And I thought, it just needs a bit of work. I thought, it just needs shaping up a bit more.
Yeah.
And I said to Dominic, look, let me have a go at this. I think I can make it work, you know. And when we came back to England, I went into a studio called Fairview, just outside Hull, in a place called Willoughby, where I'd worked with some of the bands previously. And I got Kate to come up, and Rog, and we did a little bit of tweaking, and we decided to try and do some vocals on it as well.
No.
We sat in the studio and wrote the lyrics together, and put some vocals on, and then I mixed the whole thing. and then sent it off to Dominic, and he said, great, we'll put it out. So that was the, that became the first General Wine Festival album. And then we did the second one, we did it all at Fairview, literally wrote the whole thing as we went along in the studio. You know, there was nothing prepared at all from what I remember. We just made it up on the spot.
Great. And did it do well? I mean, I don't know how you quantified that.
I don't know how well it did. All Saints Records disappeared for a while, and then it was revived. Dominic had an illness.
So, this is interesting, though. I mean, we're kind of skimming over it, but what we're now entering a phase where you are, if you're happy with it and your collaborators are happy with it, that is payment enough, it sounds like to me.
Yeah. I speak to Kate occasionally still, and he always says, I've been listening to that record, and he'll say, oh, it sounds great. What a great time that was, you know.
Great.
So that's payment enough in a way.
Yeah, exactly. So, I've got a big kind of word that I've highlighted here when I was going through this next section of your career, and it's like, I think you are a myth maker, that you create kind of intriguing little Easter egg type mini myths which create a greater kind of Bill Nelson cinematic universe. And it's just fascinating to me because, you know, I grew up loving, you know, kind of concept albums and prog rock, a lot of it, you know, and you know, stuff, Lamb Lies Down on Broadway and all this, because it painted images in my mind of maybe, you know, soundtracks to movies that don't exist, you know.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of your stuff reminds me of that kind of theory. And I'm just going to read out some of the titles because I love them so much. So the Alchemical Adventures of Sailor Bill.
Mm.
Neptune's Galaxy, Theatre of Falling Leaves, Golden Melodies of Tomorrow. I love that one. It's great. And Dream Transmission Pavilion.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, if I just saw those things in a record store, I'd buy them on the spot. So tell me about that period then. So you were really getting heavily into a more kind of instrumental, kind of ambient vibe as well.
One thing that I'd done back in the late 70s when I was recording the Red Noise album was that I'd gone into taking a lunch break during the recording. I went into London and went into the actual Tower Records shop that used to be in Piccadilly. And I was thumbing through the racks, just looking for something or other, nothing specific. And saw an album called The Pavilion of Dreams. And it was by someone called Harold Budd.
Yes. Oh, I love that album, yeah.
I've heard of Harold before because I'd done a track on, it was a cassette only issue by Disc du Crepuscule.
Disc du Crepuscule, I remember them, yeah.
And there was, on this cassette release, there were people like John Fox, Harold Budd, Michael Nyman. And I had a track on it, and asked me to do a track, and I did a little track called The Shadow Garden. And anyway, I took this Harold album, which I bought, and took it back to the studio, and I said to John Leckie, can you just take this on? I'll have a listen to it. The titles are really intriguing on the back, you know. And there was a record deck in the studio, and he put it on, and through the monitors, and it was just the most amazing, beautiful sound I'd ever heard, you know.
Wow.
Instantly fell in love with it. And then, as that happened, a few years later, I actually met Harold for the first time. A mutual friend brought him up to Yorkshire, to where I lived. And we just hit it off straight away. We were absolutely simpatico, you know.
Yeah.
And I've got this image in my head of him being a very austere, serious composer, you know.
Yeah.
And he was just a hoot. He was complete, you know, hilarious and funny and, you know, warm. So we that started a long friendship for over 30 years.
Oh, fantastic.
And in 2018, it was my 70th birthday, and I did a concert in Leeds at Leeds University's music school. It's called the Clockworkers Hall. And I decided that was going to be my final live appearance. I just record from now on. And Harold, who lived in LA, heard about this, and he said, "I'm coming over for it."
Oh, wow.
And I said, no, you can't. Because he was, by this time, he was in his 80s, and he'd had a fall, broken his hip, and wasn't, you know, easy traveller. It wasn't easy for him. He said, "No, I insist, I'm coming over." I said, "Well, okay, well, if you come over, I want you to play on three numbers with me." And he said, "Yeah, okay." So he came over for the gig and sat in on three numbers. And he stayed here in the village where we live. And we took him to places like Castle Howard and the Hepworth Gallery.
Oh, beautiful, yeah.
And out for meals and stuff. And then he went back and he said, "Look, you know, I'm probably never going to be able to travel that distance again, but hopefully I'll try and get over and see you again if I can." And we hugged and off he went on his train down to once again, playing back to Los Angeles. Then in 2020, he had a stroke and was put in hospital and started to get over the stroke and was put into the hospital's rehabilitation section where they help people recover from strokes. And whilst in there, he caught COVID off of
family. Oh, Jesus.
And passed away.
Oh.
So I was absolutely gutted. He was such a good friend.
COVID has taken some. Yeah, COVID has taken some. It took my brother during that period as well.
Really? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I lost my brother as well. Not to COVID, but back in
26, 20 or something. Oh dear. Anyway.
So one of the things that I did with Harold was that we went to New Orleans and recorded in Daniel Lanois' studio.
Right.
It was an album that Harold had called By the Dawn's Early Light. And it was all stuff he'd actually composed and written down on manuscript because he's a proper trained academic musician in that sense. And he wanted me to play on it. And I said, "How do you know I don't read music?" And he said, "Oh, it's okay, don't worry, just go and do it." So went over there, and there was BJ Cole on pedal steel guitar, Harold on piano, Mabel Wong on viola, and who else? And that might be it. Me on guitar. And in Daniel Lanois' studio, it's not like a recording studio. It was an old plantation type mansion, and in the massive hall of the mansion, that was the recording area.
Wow.
The mixing desk was just a few feet in front of where you played, but there was no separation. What the engineer did was, when he was taking something, he would put headphones on to listen to it, so that there was no, you know.
Yeah.
And then you know, play it back afterwards. And we sat around in a circle by candlelight. And there was this place, this studio full of Day of the Dead figures and,
wow,
you know, that sort of, you know, ambience, Mexican kind of ambience. And we just improvised to what I don't know was coming. having worked. And that was a joy. And Harold always said to me afterwards, he said, you know, that was the best recording experience I've ever had.
Wow.
Did a lot, you know. But it was a magic time then.
I love those things that are not really planned properly. I'm not a jazz musician. I don't read music or anything like that, but I'm good at listening.
Yeah.
And that's the important thing. But I had a similar experience, albeit not in such a beautifully decorated space, with the Radiophonic Workshop guys, the original guys.
Yeah.
And we made an improvised album called... I can't remember what it's called now. Anyway, it turned out to be really good. Some of it was terrible, as improvisation can be. But when it was edited down and mixed properly, some of it was transcendental, you know. So anyway, so there's a lot of dreams in your titles.
Yeah, I was being a dreamer.
But it's great, you know, it reminds me, it's kind of like a surrealist Jean Cocteau-esque kind of attitude. All right, so your online diaries, Diary of a Hyperdreamer. Tell me about that. That sounds like a fascinating concept.
Yeah, well, at one point I was involved with Robert Fripp's DGM label, Discipline Global Mobile. As a time when Robert was signing other people to it, and then it got too much to deal with, and he decided he was just going to use it for his own stuff. But during that point of time, I was down at his house where he lived, and we had a conversation, went for dinner and had a conversation, and he said, you know, you should do an online diary. I said, oh, I've never kept a diary, you know, I've never had time for that. He said, oh, you should do it. And he said, I do one, and, you know, I'm sure people would be interested in seeing what goes on in the process. So I thought I'd give it a go and started doing one. And eventually, there were two volumes of it published by a company called Pomona Books. And I've tried to continue it, but I have to admit, in the last year or so, the last entry I did was June of last year.
Right.
And I just, it's partly because my eyesight's really terrible now, because I have eye injections every 4 weeks.
Oh no. Shit.
Yeah, basically, it's a result of diabetes.
I've got diabetes as well. I really don't want to go down that route. Okay, not eating any more sugar again. That's it.
Well, I've probably had it since I was a child, actually.
Right.
Now I know the symptoms and, you know, I've had the experience of dealing with it. I look back on my childhood and I can see things that were possibly wrong.
Right.
But it was never diagnosed until about 6 years ago.
Right.
And that's a result. That's resulted in. They said to me when I was diagnosed, said, "We think you've had this at least 10, possibly 20 years."
And often happens. Often happens. But that's if you don't get checked up. You know, you've got to.
Yeah. Well, I was one of these people that just tried to stay away from doctors as much as possible.
It's a very common thing with northern people, especially.
Yeah. So it was never. And it was diagnosed sort of accidentally because I had what I thought was an infection, and they took a blood sample and found out that the blood count was 25 point something instead of
right.
5 as it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I had a similar thing actually. I went to do some lecturing at the University of Virginia in America, and I was staying with my friend who was a professor, and he's got this beautiful house on the outskirts of town, and it's just the town and then wilderness, right? So it's like I was walking around in his garden, it's a beautiful day in June, and there's deer, and there's, you know, occasionally the Aber brown bear comes in and all that, and I'm going, this is fantastic. It's like something out of an American wilderness story. Of course I got a tick by it, and I didn't know what it was for a while, and I thought, this is not looking good. What's this all about? And it was kind of eating into my leg. And As soon as the doctor saw it, I could see the look of horror on his face. So you've got to go to the, you've got to go to A&E immediately. And I'm going, oh, okay. And they did tests and they said, you know, you've got diabetes and you, and it's meaning that, you know, it's not going to heal up, essentially, unless you do, unless you really take some action quick. And it, anyway, having diabetes generally is not very good. But it's one of the things, isn't it? It it reduces your the body's ability to heal.
Yeah.
And anyway, so that's all from the doctor's surgery today. Okay, so I'm going to try and wrap this up in some shape or form. So you got hearing loss in 2014 in one ear, is that right?
Yeah, I've lost my hearing in my right ear.
Oh, that's a terrible thing, isn't it? No more stereo mixers then for you.
Well, this is the weird thing. If I'm listening to the TV and I put my finger in my right ear,
yeah,
it doesn't block anything out because there's nothing going in to start with, you know?
Right.
And... but yet, when I'm sat in front of my monitors upstairs doing my recording, I can sense exactly where the stereo pitches.
Really?
I can sense stuff coming out of the right-hand speaker, even though my right ear isn't working.
It might be to do with, obviously, the human auditory brain processing is incredibly plastic. So it might well be to do with it's interpreting, cleverly interpreting phase differentials through the pinner of your ear.
Yeah.
I mean, because I do a lot of work in ambisonics and 3D sound and stuff, and I'm fascinated with all that stuff, how we perceive distance and space and location in three dimensions. Anyway, good. So another thing I wrote down here was I think your albums are like a kind of roadmap of your life. Because you've done so many, and it's like a kind of a psychogeography of your life.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
I know it's quite a profound thought, but to a certain extent. Anyway, and... have you ever done installation work?
I did do once, yes. I did a thing called Crimsworth. I released an album from that as well. It was an artist who, Rob, I forgot his name now, it's kind of a while ago. He did an installation where he covered the walls with a ceramic-based paper. And then painted sort of abstract washes on these walls. And then the floor of the, this was in a prepared room. The floor of the room was waterproofed and it was filled with like a black oil liquid. It wasn't deep, it was only, a few inches deep. And then there was a kind of a walkway built out into the centre of this room that would allow one person at a time to walk out and stand in the centre, and you get this infinite pool effect.
Yeah.
Because of the reflective black liquid, which made the wall images go down into the water, look as if they were going down. And I did a surround sound thing.
Oh, nice.
A very sort of abstract long piece. And it was called Crimsworth because it was inspired by an area called, when the artist lived, an area called Crimsworth near where he lived, which inspired me to do it. So I did the piece of music and called it Crimsworth as well and put that out as an album. And it's just a really long, slow, evolving. It's pianos that slow down.
And nice.
Reverse, some of them long delays, reverbs on this. It's an interesting piece.
I love the idea. It just occurred to me because I'm doing a big immersive sound concert in Sheffield in May. I love the idea of the artist not even being present when their work is being performed or not performed, being reproduced in 3D. Because I often think that 3D sound has a kind of metaphor in a kind of, you know, moving spirits kind of way and ghostly way. And there's something kind of very poignant and elegant about an artist kind of fading away from his own work in the physical sense, and then just leaving this residue, which is just beautiful. And actually, Robert Fripp did a Frippatronics piece that I witnessed in London, where he played for like half an hour through about a million Watkins copycats, and then just left it to continue feeding back on itself for like 2 days. And that is, anyway, it's a bit similar to that. Well, this has been a fantastic interview. I mean, I must say, it's a joy talking to you. Thank you. So I always finish these interviews with some what are apparently stupid kind of smash hits questions, but they end up being quite revealing. So don't worry, it's not a test. So what's your favourite film, or one of them?
Oh, gosh, so many. Citizen Kane's one.
Yeah, it always withstands repeated viewings, doesn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Book?
Book? Oh, gosh, I've got thousands of books. I'm reading one at the moment. I'll tell you, I'll just say the one I'm reading at the moment is Bill Frisell's autobiography.
Oh, yeah.
Dreamer, it's called.
Right, cool. Okay, TV show, past, present, box set, anything you want?
The Avengers.
Ah! The original one with Emma Peel.
Yeah, we're going with Diana Rigg.
Diana Rigg.
Nuts about her.
Oh, God. She's. And do you know, her photos from that period keep popping up on my timeline. And I'm going, she is just gorgeous. Yeah. And all that fantastic kind of 60s. Geometric kind of dresses and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently she used to design her own costumes for the show. And the sad thing is that, you know, she passed away a couple of years ago.
That's right.
You suddenly realise how time, how life's so short, you know.
Oh, really? Well, Raquel Welch yesterday.
Yeah. There's so many people this last
year. I know. Makes you wonder if it's connected with the whole COVID thing in some way.
Yeah.
Or maybe we're just noticing it more now. Anyway,
yeah.
Who's your favourite composer? I mean, as in, yeah, I mean, sort of more classical, I suppose, or 20th century classical, avant-garde, or...
Oh, gosh. I've got loads of favourites, but Debussy.
Yeah. Knew you were going to say Satie and Fauré and all that.
Yeah.
I love all them impressionist things. Yeah.
Fauré's Requiem, mind.
Oh, beautiful. And I love all the Russian composers from the early 20th century.
Yeah. Just
brilliant. Changed the world for me.
Yeah.
Who's your favourite other guitarist?
At the moment, I would say Bill Frisell.
Right.
I really like him. I've probably got more of his albums than any other guitar player. I used to have, I still have, an awful lot of Chet Atkins guitar albums from the late 50s and early 60s.
Oh, right, okay.
When I was in my early stages of learning guitar, I used to really love Chet Atkins playing.
Who's your favourite visual artist or conceptual artist? We haven't really talked about your art, your visual artwork. I mean, you're an artist as well, aren't you?
Well, yeah. I'm a perpetual art student, put it.
We're all, every day's a school day, don't worry. We're all learning all the time.
Yeah.
But who is your favourite?
I like David Hockney.
Right.
I like probably his approach more than...
Yeah.
What he actually does. It's like his thinking is interesting.
I agree with you. I've been to several of the of his big shows that have been on at the Royal Academy and stuff like that. And the idea of him is somehow is bigger than the actual works. I think it's become a bit of a kind of trope, his work. You know, anyway, it's just the way I think about commercial artists. But
on a different guy, Austin Osborne's there.
No.
He died in the, I think, late 50s, early 60s. He was a child prodigy as an artist. He something exhibited at the, I think it was the Royal College of Art when he was just a child. And his style, in some ways, is superficially a little like Aubrey Beardsley, but it also developed and he got into what you might call surrealist art before surrealism proper
right
underway.
Proto-surrealism then.
Yeah, he was actually an occultist.
Ah, well. We love all that stuff. I do, don't we?
And one time he was briefly a member of Alistair Crowley's order, not the Golden Dawn, the one that came after that. And he devised a system of magical working, which is really interesting, which is, it uses visuals called sigilization. And it's basically, if you have a desire, you write it out, cross out any recurring letters, so that, you know, if there's two T's, you cross one of them out, so there's only one T. You then form that into a graphic design. You can invert the letters or put them around each other. You make a sort of design of that, and that becomes a sigil. And then you forget it, you put it away.
Wow.
You might do several of them, and you put them away. So then, at some point in the future, you pick one out and you don't know what it is because you can't actually read it as a sentence or anything, and you've forgotten the combination, as it were. And then you do a certain kind of magical meditation on it, and things happen.
Wow.
And there are lots of eyewitness accounts of this guy.
So it's like spells, really.
It's sort of like a spell, but they actually... there was, for instance, he did one that said that he wished to have the strength of a tiger because he couldn't shift this massive wardrobe he got. And he did this ritual with it and everything. And somebody was there with him and watched him actually move this heavy wardrobe on his own quite easily, you know. Another time... he got roses to fall out of the ceiling.
No.
And fall out, come out from the ceiling and fall on the floor. So, you know, I had a big interest in esoteric stuff.
Me too.
For a while. And I started joining the Rosicrucian Order.
I'm interested in all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and so I eventually, because there was a branch of it in Leeds, I started going to, and I made friends with a guy who was the master of the temple at that time, and he used to make magical implements, swords and wands and pentacles and all this kind of stuff.
So this is the Gnostic kind of thing.
Yes, sort of. I mean, Gnosticism is I suppose you could say an esoteric branch of Christianity, but I became at this Rosicrucian temple. I became the master of the temple, and then became the master of the temple, and then I joined up with a London-based branch of a French Masonic order.
Right,
and started going down every month to meetings there. And within that French Masonic order was another order called Martinism. And it's Louis-Claude de Saint-Martin was the founder of that back in the 1700s. And that was a magical order within what ostensibly appeared to be Panasonic organ, and did that for a long time until I moved to Japan, where I lived for a year. So I've still got tons and tons of, I've got rare manuscripts.
This is fascinating stuff, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I was really, really, you know, deeply into it. Now, I look back on it, I think, well, there's a certain romance about all that.
Yeah.
And that's what, there's a glamour. And that glamour and romance actually isn't what you should be thinking about when you're doing this stuff. It's
what's the end game of it? I mean, what's the kind of ambition of the beliefs that you bought into? I mean,
the thing with Martyrism, for instance, is to be a kind of God's agent,
right?
You know,
but it is an enlightenment thing. Is it? Is it about becoming enlightened and helping your fellow people, or
it's a benign thing,
right?
It's, I mean, there are, you know, darker sides to the occult, but this is a, if you like a terrible white magic thing. I've also for a long time since the whole college thing has been interested in Buddhism, and
me too. Yeah,
that's kind of more my thing these days.
Yeah,
although I'm not. My wife is a practicing Buddhist. She's a member of a Japanese Buddhist school that has a place in the UK. And she does meditations and chanting regularly. I don't.
I know a lot of Buddhists, yeah. I mean, I work with Tina Turner, and she was a strong advocate for Buddhism. Without making a big deal out of it, I have to say, which is great, cool, and the way it should be. Okay, moving on. Which of your own work are you most proud of?
Well, one of them is The Alchemical Adventures of Sailor Bill.
Right.
I mean, in some ways, I think it's kind of one of the best things I've ever done.
Great.
I approached it thinking about trying to do an orchestral-based album with vocals and instrumental tracks, themed around my sort of fond memories of East Coast of Yorkshire in the 50s and 60s. And that's the general sort of concept of it. But I did it all at home. And I listen to it now and I just can't understand how I did it. I just, you know, it's one of the few albums of mine that I do listen to occasionally, you know, and I still think, gosh, I
just think we're all different people. We're all different people at different times, aren't we? And an authentic expression of your creativity sometimes just pours through you, like from your subconscious.
But I rarely listen to my recordings. I mean, once I've done them, then
move on. Yeah.
I'm not
really there. Okay. Unfulfilled ambition.
Oh God! I wonder if I ever had an ambition. I don't think there is one. I'm absolutely content with my lot, even though sometimes it's been really hard, you know. It's as it should be.
Yeah. Good.
Goes from step to step, you know.
Yeah. What have we got left here? So. What's your favourite guitar?
Again, I've got loads. I've got 70 guitars.
I knew you got loads, but you've got to pick one.
I swap them around every few weeks. I get another 8 out. Put 8 away. You know. I guess, I mean, it's easy for me to say my original Gibson that my dad bought me.
Yeah.
I've still got that. I mean, it's obviously got a lot of sentiment attached to it. It's not in absolute original condition because I had it refinished in the 70s, but that's probably one I would never ever part with, and it's in my will to go to my son when I go. So, but I've kept my latest guitar a while back. It's a reissue of a 1962 Gretsch White Falcon.
Wow.
It's really nice. There's only 15 of them there from Europe.
Wow.
And I managed to get one. And it's a really nice guitar, and I'm really impressed with that as well. So the visual of the guitar is always important.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Those Gretsch guitars are so beautiful, aren't they? Finally, oh no, tell me your favourite drum machine first.
Oh gosh. Well, at the moment I've got an Akai MPC X.
Right.
Which actually I've been a bit lazy of late. I've not bothered programming it. I'm using just notes from Cubase and stuff.
But, yeah.
I would say that I had the TR-808, which was great.
Yeah.
But that, when I told you about earlier on, the obscure...
Yeah, that sounds like... I would put that on the list personally. It sounds great.
Yeah, I think that was an interesting thing because you actually could play it like a kit.
Exactly. And finally, what's your favourite synthesizer?
Oh, well, I had an old retro one again, but I had a CS70N Yamaha.
Yes, I remember.
And it didn't have any preset sounds. You had to build the sounds yourself. And then you could store them on it looked like a little thin strip of plastic that went in the and you would set up a sound and then you could store it on this piece of plastic and it would be one sound on one little piece.
Really? I've never heard of that.
And then you'd put it back in and it would, you know, play the same sound again.
That's a pretty weird concept. I like it though.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up.
But the sound of this thing was great. I mean, it was obviously an analog synth.
Yeah.
Polyphonic, and I managed to get some really nice sounds.
Fantastic. Okay, so we're at the end. Just one final thing. What have you got coming up next?
Well, I've got a load of albums. Yeah, I've got at least 8 albums finished, but not all mastered. And not all the artwork done for them, but I record every day constantly, so it's like an ongoing process. And usually I don't have a particular album concept or anything in mind. I'll listen through to what I've done and decide, oh, that goes with that track, and that goes there, and that goes there. I see it's an album about so-and-so, you know.
Right.
So it comes together that way. So I've got quite a few waiting for artwork. I've got one called Fables of the Future, Echoes of the Past. One called All the Fun of the Fair, one called Starlight Stories, and so on.
Wow. You're a total inspiration to me, Bill, I have to say. You know, whenever I wake up in the morning, I've obviously got my own studio and stuff, and I'm going, oh God, what am I going to write today? I mean, you are an inspiration. So thank you so much for sharing your world with us. And I hope we get to meet at some point. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? I'm not even looking at you, let alone anything else. So this will be coming out in the next couple of weeks. I'll let you know when it's happening. And it's just been an absolute joy. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bill. Cheers, mate. Bye.
Take care.
Bye. That was Bill, and I suspect we could have probably talked for a lot longer, but I can honestly say one of my favourites. He's a person of enormous depth, and I think it seems to me that there are lots of people I've interacted with online for whom he is their absolute hero, which is surprising to me because he's like one of those artists who isn't massively high profile, but he has such depth and it has such an impact on people that people feel very loyal towards him. I've already had a few people going, why didn't you ask him about that? And you clearly don't know about this album and everything. I can't keep up with all his output. You know, I'm not a dedicated Bill Nelson fan, but I am an admirer of his work and his the way that he approaches his work.
So apologies if there's any errors or I missed something out. The intention of these interviews aren't to be thoroughly biographical and to cover every base. They're a general chat about stuff. So I cover, the general shape of his career or anybody's career that I'm talking to. So how is everyone? Still bloody cold. Insanely cold. Send me an email if you wish to comment on the podcast, or we've got any ideas for guests, sections, fun things particularly, ways that we can contact guests is good. electronicallymartin@gmail.com, and please consider contributing to my Patreon site, which helps me pay for all the people who helped me create this. patreon.com/electronicallyhours. Another great guest for you next week. Looking forward to speaking to you then. Bye. Philip Lyons, dear Martin. Long-term listener to your podcast, I'm ploughing my way through your back catalogue. Notable highlights are Kim Wilde, the hilarious Pete Wiley, Peter Hook, Stephen Morris, and your old mucker Glenn, of course, plus the unforgettable Gary Newman with that chilling and unforgettable aircraft story. Wow, horror show. Any road up... That's a northern saying. Any road up, I saw you at Rewind in 2018 and was just blown away how good it was to reconnect with Hem17 again. I really enjoyed the show. I didn't go last year, but we will no doubt catch up on the next tour. Please keep playing. Now then, this brings me neatly onto a review of Rewind 2022. I don't think we need all this. It's very nice of him to send it to me, but it's very, very long.
We'll read this in our own time.
Yeah. He wants me to reach out to Phil Oakey to do the podcast, but I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. Keep up the good work, Martin. Okay, ready, let's do it. Phil Lyons.
Thanks, Phil. This is from Martin Anders. Martin with an I. Hi, Martin with a Y. First of all, thank you for making my everyday drive to work so much more interesting by providing all these fascinating and entertaining conversations in your podcast. Being relatively new to the party, I'm looking forward to catching up by listening to the great backlog of episodes. I find almost all of your guests extremely interesting.
Yeah.
Please allow me to suggest Robert Gurl from DAF as a future guest. I guess he will be accessible through Facebook, and maybe he's up for it. He might be of interest to the rest of your audience as well. Sorry if Robert has already been suggested. As I say, I'm catching up.
That's write it right, down. Martin. Write it down. So, Robert Gurl from Deutsche Amerikanische Freundschaft.
Robert Gurl. Cheers from Hamburg. Martin. Thank you, Martin.